You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, community-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And if you'd like to support the station, please go to KRUUFM.com, and you can see how to do it there. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. It's not, it's cloudy, but it's not snowing. It's not raining. We're happy.
That is true. And we have a very special show in store today, but unfortunately, our guest has not yet called in. We're scrambling. This is the danger of live radio. Scrambling at the moment.
But we can talk about the
trying to locate him. So, Mom, why don't you tell us who are we hoping to speak with today?
Well, we're hoping to speak with a
That must be him.
Let's hope. He's James R. I don't know if it's Dottie or Doty. It's D-O-T-Y-M-D. Professor at the Department of Neurosurgery in Stanford University, at the director and the director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. And he is on the phone right now.
Hi, welcome to Writers' Voices.
Hi, how are you? I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Can you, first of all, pronounce your last name for us so we are sure that we get it right?
Doty.
All right, very good.
Okay.
All right. So tell us a little bit more about Dr. Doty, Mom.
Okay. As I was saying, he's a professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Stanford University and the director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, CCARE, of which the Dalai Lama was a founding benefactor. He's also a philanthropist who has funded health clinics throughout the world and has endowed scholarships and chairs at multiple universities. He serves on the board of a number of nonprofits, including the Charter for Compassion International and the Dalai Lama Foundation. He's had quite an interesting life, and this book is called Into the Magic Shop. Is it just, you know,
it's Into the Magic Shop, a neurosurgeon's quest to discover the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. And like I wrote in my blog post, that should attract a lot of attention. That pretty much covers all the bases.
Yes, it does.
So, that first of all, let me ask if you'd prefer to be addressed as Dr. Doty or as James? Or something else?
Either one is fine. I have no gem in those.
All right.
Feel comfortable with. I'm easy.
All right. So tell us why you wrote this book.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure what the process is for others, but in my own particular case, as you can see from that wonderful bio that was read, I already have a very busy life.
Yeah, I'll say.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. What I found was, though, that I would give talks which included a bit of my background, and oftentimes the reason I included it was to have people understand the reality that many of the actions or activities we engage in as we grow up, if you will, are manifestations of experiences or events that have occurred or happened to us as children. And many of the people found that the stories and the trajectory of my own life were very inspiring and motivating to them. And ultimately, I was approached by a variety of individuals to consider writing a book. And finally, I could no longer resist.
You succumbed to the pressure.
I succumbed to the pressure. And it was also at a point where I felt, if you will, ready to do it.
What do you think it took for you to be ready to do that?
Well, first of all, it had been, from when I was first approached and realized that there was interest, I did not want to write a book just to write a book. I wanted to write a book if it could be of benefit to people. And once I had been asked multiple times, it started in the back of my mind saying, well, geez, how would I work this? What would this involve, et cetera, et cetera. And really, the final event was I had actually been invited to Desmond Tutu's 80th birthday party, believe it or not, And I was at a book launch event there, and an individual came up to me and introduced himself. And frankly, I oftentimes meet people who I don't remember, but in this case I did remember him because he was 6'7" and a handsome guy. And I saw him at two more of my events, but this time at Stanford in the Bay Area, right? And I said, wow, that's very strange. And then he showed up at another event I was at and came up, introduced himself again, and he said, you know, I'm a literary agent. I have been inspired by your work over the last few years and the stories you tell, and I only work with authors who I myself personally are inspired by. Additionally, my father's my hero. He's elderly. I've shown him some of your videos, and he's been very moved, and I would really like to do this for my father. Well, how could I resist that pitch?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, what's interesting about that is I agreed to do it, and he and I worked together over a three-month period to sort of develop a proposal, and he ultimately had me speak to a variety of editors at publishing houses. And then it actually went to auction, and for not an insignificant sum. And what's amazing, within, I think, the first 2 weeks, the rights sold in 12 countries based on just the proposal.
Well, I think that tells you that there's a hunger for this kind of information.
No, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is I never Googled him or asked for any further information from him once he and I had that conversation. It actually turned out he was Desmond Tutu's literary agent and had been Mandela's agent, had done a book with Richard Branson and other notable individuals, and had, I think, 4 New York Times bestselling authors in the last year. So
whoa. You were in good company. Good company, yes.
Yes.
Wow. So it took 3 months to put together the proposal. It sounds like from there things moved very quickly.
Yeah. It does take time, even though I had told many stories, and we also went through other aspects of my life. Putting in the context of an arc of a story, as you probably know, is a little bit more difficult.
Right.
And then over the next 2 years, from 5 to 7 in the morning, at least twice a week, I worked on this book, and ultimately it manifested.
So, did you write it yourself?
No. As I recall.
Well, sometimes people who are as successful as you are at something else, when they go to write a book, they bring in a ghostwriter. And they may not always reveal, and so maybe I'm not even supposed to ask that question.
No, but what I will tell you is, though, he is a person... who's really a wonderful woman by the name of Laura Love, actually. And as this was a new sort of area to me, what we would do is I would write or dictate, and she forced me to stay focused and in the context of the trajectory of the story, although it changed somewhat. There would be areas where she would say, look, Jim, you need some more dialogue here, or I think this is what you should focus on here, and that's what I would do. And she did contribute some to that as well, so I don't want to say that she did not.
So what you really had was a writing coach.
Actually, yeah. And it was wonderful, though, and we actually became very close friends. In fact, actually, it was interesting. I had her, you know, I told you I was doing this from 5 to 7 in the morning, right? So usually we'd meet in my office, but one time we met at my home office, and I forgot to tell my wife. Oh, she was not up at 5, so she walks into my office, and I'm with this attractive woman at 5 in the morning having coffee, right?
Now, are you normally a morning person?
Yes. Okay. I usually wake up quite early.
That's good, because for me to write a book at 5 to 7 in the morning, it would not happen.
It would not be done.
Okay. Yeah, could not be done. Now, maybe midnight to 2 a.m., I might pull it off.
Well, remember, I'm a neurosurgeon, so my day actually starts at 6.
Oh, wow.
or 6:30, so that was not an unusual time to be up.
So, as you mentioned, you are a neurosurgeon, which we have this image of being a very scientific kind of career, and yet your book might be called a little new agey.
You know, it's geez, I hope it's not. I think because I do clearly indicate I have no belief system. In fact, I think I very explicitly say I'm an atheist. So there are not many new agey people who are atheists. But I, as you notice from the list of individuals who've given endorsements, some of them are the most well-respected spiritual and religious leaders in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you also have very prominent business people as well as neuroscientists. I think there is a component clearly of spirituality in there. I comment on events that occur to me, or at least I lay out events that occur to me, but I don't put any type of connotation other than these events occurred. And they may be extraordinarily moving events, but I don't attribute that to necessarily a higher power. Now, the other side of the coin, though, is knowing all of these spiritual people who I do have personal relationships with, there's not a one of them who doesn't believe I'm a highly spiritual person.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and I can understand
I
that.
I can, too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sometimes I used to have a problem with, you know, I don't know if you know much about Fairfield, which is where the station is. It's the center of the Transcendental Meditation Movement in the United States.
Okay, I got it. Oh, Fairfield, Iowa.
Fairfield, Iowa. The home.
Oh, of course. In fact, I've been invited there many, many times.
Have you been here?
No, I haven't. You know, the problem for me is I would love to be everywhere.
Right.
Oh, sure.
I just, unfortunately, I have a job that requires me to be here.
Well, I'll put a plug in. If you ever do have the time to come to Fairfield, we would love to have you, and I think you would love Fairfield, too.
Well, you know, my wife is very interested in Ayurvedic medicine as well.
Ah, yes.
And that's why she keeps after me to go there. So, no, I'd love to come sometime. And, it'd be wonderful.
So I guess, you know, where I was going to is that there's a lot of, in my everyday interactions, there's a lot of, you know, people talk about being spiritual and spirituality and so forth. It's kind of, I don't think you find that in every small town, but certainly we do here. And I used to have an issue with people who would refer to someone as being more spiritual than somebody else.
Uh-huh.
Because my feeling is that we are all 100% spirit.
Well, I think that's correct. I think that...
Now, some people are more aware.
I agree, yes. Yeah. Some individuals are more connected to that reality than others.
Right.
Some people feel much more a part of, if you will, this idea of oneness and that we're all interconnected than other people, and I think that's probably what they refer to. You know, when you mention new agey, you know, I think sometimes people go off with, people use that term, things such as crystals or energy fields and all of these things, which are not my domain, and I won't comment any further, but that's not necessarily my interest. My interest is giving tools and inspiration through my own experience and not necessarily naming it other than this was an event that happened to me and it had this effect. And through this science that I have worked in this field of neuroscience and psychology, we can document physiologic changes. We can see how epigenetic phenomena occur when these types of techniques are utilized. So my interest is a very secular one based on science, not so much promoting the use of crystals or any other types of things of which I don't have experience and of which, at least from a traditional science perspective, there's not a lot of evidence to support.
Well, I guess at one time, you know, meditation, which is part of the technique that you learned, was considered New Age, but it really isn't anymore, is it?
No, I think, in fact, I would suggest to you that it has become completely mainstream, and it shows you that many things that have been considered heretical in the context of science, in fact, end up once studied, clearly have a scientific basis, and I think meditation is one of those. That while these types of practices began with Eastern religions, that it has been found after one, if you will, strips off the dogma, that these techniques are extraordinarily powerful. And I think it also emphasizes, and in fact, probably where some of the more New Agey stuff comes from, is the fact that we do not appreciate the power that we have over our own life and our own bodies in the context of changing things.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this is the basis of the placebo effect. How is it possible that you have one drug that's a sugar pill and you have another that theoretically has these active components, yet in 80% of both groups of people who are given them, they have an effect, an identical or similar effect physiologically. And it clearly has to be because having a belief in the ability of something to do something makes it happen. And so whether it's a belief in the energy of crystals or a belief in different types of therapies, that we may not see per se a scientific basis for through traditional mechanisms. What we do know, though, is that your own belief system and getting to that, if you will, can have really quite profound effects on your physiology.
That's why whenever I'm prescribed something, or if I was in the hospital any time and they came with a pill, I would ask them, now, what is this supposed to do?
So you could focus on getting it to do that.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I did.
That too, but she just never takes it after they give it to her.
Well, the thing I'm wondering is, I understand the placebo effect, that you can take something that's a sugar pill and has the effect because of the belief, but is the opposite true? If you take an actual drug and without belief, will it still work?
Well, I would actually give you a couple sort of examples that may support that. There have been individuals who are great meditators, if you will, and have been given certain types of drugs, whether they be psychedelics or other types of drugs, which we do know have an effect, and they have absolutely no effect on them.
Hmm.
So I think it can work both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it really emphasizes the reality that our consciousness has a huge impact on this vessel we call our body. And this is also an explanation, as an example, why monks, and there's actually a guy, I think I can't think of his name, but he's in Belgium, who has climbed Mount Everest in shorts.
Oh, my gosh.
And can go swimming in, you know, very, very cold water and can sit for 2 hours or 3 hours in ice water because he has this incredible control over his physiology. And this is something that each of us, I really believe, has the ability to do. And what I do in the context of my book is to give a very much an example of my own experience and the techniques that I use to accomplish the same thing. Because in my own instance, as you know, I grew up in poverty with a father who is an alcoholic and a mother who is an invalid and had was paralyzed and was chronically depressed, attempted suicide, neither had gone to college. We were on public assistance. And through walking into a magic shop and meeting a woman who happened to be there, not the owner, but the owner's mother, who knew nothing about magic per se. In a period of 6 weeks interacting with this woman, she really gave me a set of tools that very much allowed me to do the things that I'm talking about, which was to see the world in a different way and to give me tools that allowed me to change my own circumstance in the world and how I reacted to my own circumstance. So I say that it was my first experience with this idea of neuroplasticity, or if you will, hardwiring your brain in a different way, or rewiring your brain, if you will.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Dr. James Doty, the author of Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the vagus nerve, because I've known about that for some time, and I use it frequently. I'm a singer, so I can belly breathe very easily, and it's... It's very helpful, like you're in the dentist chair, you know, and they're drilling in your teeth.
No, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, utilizing these techniques in all, in a variety of areas that are either stressful or painful or could be painful really can have a quite a profound effect. And what people don't also appreciate is that when you change how you react in the world, the world changes how it reacts to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very important point.
And, it is.
And there's actually, you know, this book is amazing, and I think it's one of the few books I will say on the show everybody should read.
Yes, I agree. I agree totally.
And it's more than just lessons about neuroplasticity and so forth. There's a number of different things that you can take away from this book as the most important thing.
Yeah.
And one of them is the fact that this woman in the magic shop, the impact that she had on your life, and the lesson of how we can have an impact on somebody else and not sometimes even know it, but sometimes you do know and you're making an effort, but I mean, it changed the world for you.
No, and I think that is one of the gifts of this book, is that it shows by my own example how one person's intervention, taking the time and also recognizing that I had potential, and even though I was in this particular circumstance, she saw within me something that made her reach out to try to help me, which she profoundly did. And the wonderful thing is, each of us, no matter who we are, have the ability to impact another's life in a positive way. Sometimes it can be a smile. Sometimes it can take a little more effort, where you look at them, you talk to them, and you realize that there is something that you really could do, make a phone call, give them something, spend time with them, educate them, that really doesn't cost you very much, if you will, but that interaction can have a profound, profound effect on them. I'll give you a really quick example. I used to go to a coffee shop locally, and one day I took my 9-year or 10-year-old son with me, and there was a young lady who was the barista who I would talk to frequently, a very pleasant person, and she saw my son, and we started talking again, and she said, you know, I have a 9-year-old daughter. And I said, oh, wow, that's interesting. Long story short, though, is she had gotten pregnant in college, had to drop out, kept a child, and her dream was to become a physician. And she was still working towards that goal, but had some difficulties and challenges. And, you know, I just saw how she was working so hard, and this was really her dream. I said, listen, let me look at your stuff. Maybe I can help you. And I spent a few hours helping her, learning more about her situation. And since I am in this area, made the effort to make a few phone calls, write a letter for her, and she's now a physician.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not saying that to toot my own horn, but I'm just saying that each of us has a gift to give to another, mm-hmm. and we may not even realize what that gift is. And that great thing is, when you give that gift away freely, it turns out being an incredible gift for yourself in terms of your own physiology and making you feel better. And in some ways, this gets back to this book in the neuroscience, which is that there is a remarkable amount of evidence that shows that when you care or nurture another, it has a huge effect on your own physiology. And in fact, there was a study that was done in terms of volunteering in women over the age of 65. One group did, one group did not. The group that volunteered a certain number of minimum hours per day, their life expectancy was increased almost twofold by doing so.
Wow.
I mean, that's really the profound effect of caring and nurturing. And there were a couple exceptions, and those exceptions were if the person was doing it for recognition or some sort of reward, and it was not selfless giving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've always thought that the ability to easily be kind, because some people have to struggle almost to be kind. It's like their natural tendency is to be angry or complaining or something. But if it's that people who for whom kindness comes naturally are the luckiest people in the world.
Well, they get so much reward from that. But remember, I would also say that when you interact with somebody who, as you described, is not kind or is not naturally that way or seems to always be upset, if you look at them slightly differently and understand that, in fact, they may be suffering deeply. They may have wounds that have not healed, and as a result, because of the pain of those wounds, they're not able to focus on others because it is so painful for them. And when you reframe that, it actually allows you to look at them in a way that is much more kind and compassionate than to be reactive. Because oftentimes in our daily interactions with people, we run across people who are angry, upset, aggressive, et cetera, et cetera. And many times we react to them in the same manner in which they're coming towards us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And diffuse the situation, it often escalates the situation or creates our own negative energy. And as Viktor Frankl said, between stimulus and response, we can pause, and that pause really can change everything. Because if you process it in the way I described and not be reactive and be more discerning and thoughtful, it can actually diffuse the situation. Because to have aggressiveness or a fight, there usually has to be two people, right?
Takes two to tango. Yes, it does.
Exactly. And by doing those types of actions, oftentimes those people will just stop and then maybe be a little more reflective themselves. Now, I'm not saying this is 100%, but again, when we talk about what's within that book, this book gives you a variety of techniques that, through my own experience and readings, have learned are very, very powerful. And it gets back to this statement I said earlier, which is it shows you how that when you change how you react or interact with the world changes how it interacts with you. At that particular situation, when I was 12, I had a lot of anger and hostility because my life was at a dead end. I had no place to go, and even though I was bright and there, I believe, because I didn't have mentors, I didn't have access, I didn't have parents who understood. They had their own difficulties, as I described. Oftentimes, this is why children become delinquents, because why not? There's no future for them. And fundamentally, after what this woman Ruth taught me, it's not that my circumstance changed in any way. It was how I reacted to my circumstance.
Mm.
And that, from being angry and hostile to sort of having an awareness of it, having no significant emotional response, but simply be aware and accepting it and not demonstrating anger and aggressiveness at others who may have had no relationship to my situation, it then allowed others to get close to me and to help me. And that help not only from Ruth, but from the other people in my life, has really been quite profound. I mean, it allowed me to go to medical school. It allowed me to become a neurosurgeon. It allowed me to become a successful entrepreneur of a company that went public for $1.3 billion. And it also allowed me to ultimately understand that when I lost everything, the lesson that was most important was opening your heart and continuing to have this connection. And at that point, when I had nothing except stock in a company that at that time had no value, but it was my only asset, I gave it away freely because it removed this monkey off my own back, which was this belief, because I grew up in poverty and had nothing, that power and control came from having money.
Mm-hmm.
When I voluntarily gave away everything, that's actually the greatest gift I ever got, because then the world really opened to me to see that it's not about that. It's about caring. It's about connecting. And when you live a life of caring and connecting and nurturing others, the world is an extraordinary place. And that's allowed me to create the center at Stanford that studies the neuroscience of compassion and altruism. It's allowed me to have deep relationships not only with the Dalai Lama, but a number of other spiritual or religious leaders, including Amma, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, Eckhart Tolle, Desmond Tutu, and a variety of others. And it's interesting because I've had people say to me, geez, Jim, you're an atheist. How can these people embrace you? I've been a follower of so-and-so for so long, and you've gotten close to them and have been with them more than I have ever been, even though I've been a follower of theirs. And my comment is, it's not the dogma. These people can see if someone is authentic in a heartbeat. And when you're truly authentic, when you're, and all of them, at the fundamental base of their belief system is kindness and compassion for others. And if you manifest that in yourself, it doesn't matter whether you know the dogma or have memorized the dogma, it is whether you are a manifestation of that. That's why people say, don't tell me your dogma, show me who you are by your actions.
Mm. Of course, you had your, even though you lost everything monetarily, you had your skill. You had your doctor's skill.
And I certainly would not deny that. In fact, actually, a representative from Oprah called me up because there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about the fact that when the dot-com crash came, I lost around 70-some million dollars in 6 weeks and was effectively bankrupt and had to sell all of my assets pretty much. And she said, oh, my God, you know, your life must be ruined. How horrible. God, we'd love to have a show on the show to talk about this.
to share your misery, huh?
Yeah, right, exactly. Publicize it so everybody can say, oh, this guy who is very wealthy, he's lost everything, and look at him. But what I said was, why would I be... I mean, it would be insulting for me to even consider this proposition of yours, because my worst day is I'm a neurosurgeon and I get paid as in that profession better than 99.9% of people. I would be embarrassed and humiliated to sit there and whine and complain about the fact that, yes, I did lose tens of millions of dollars, but I'm still better off than almost anyone in the world. And I still get to help people and do something that's a blessed calling, and that would be insulting. And it was, in fact, the case. So, yes, even though I lost everything, even though I was no longer flying around in private jets and living quite the same level of high life, it actually was a demonstration of this idea of equanimity. Mm-hmm. You know, these types of highs in your life where you... something has gone fantastic and you feel how great things are and you feel wonderful and you have all these people giving you accolades, those are wonderful feelings to have. But if you try to attach to those and have those be the way it is all the time, you end up being miserable. Did I enjoy the wealth and all those, doing those things and interacting in some very unique situations? Of course I did. But when I lost them, it was perfectly fine too. I held them and enjoyed them when they were present, but it did not ruin me by not having them when they were gone. And it's just like when you have downturns in your life. In almost all situations, they're transient. And if you sit there and have an attachment to that in the sense you go, oh, woe is me, everything is horrible, it's going to always be this way, yes, you can be make yourself very unhappy. But if you sit there and say, this is a temporary downturn, invariably things will come up and improve. I will have an evenness of temperament. You don't have these extremes of happiness and unhappiness.
Mm-hmm. It makes a big difference, being even-tempered.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Dr. James Doty, author of Into the Magic Shop. James, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us today?
Sure. Let me get one.
All right.
Hold on for 1 second.
Okay, well, while he's doing that, we'll talk. He had mentioned some of the endorsements that he had received. And,
oh, yeah.
Like on the back cover, we have an endorsement from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, one from Arianna Huffington, who's the founder of Huffington Post, one from Dean Ornish, MD, who's also a well-known physician, author of The Spectrum, one from Rick Hansen, who is the author of Hardwiring Happiness, and I think he... I know we've had him on the show before. I can't. That wasn't for that book, but it was for a different book. And then in the front of the book, we've got everyone.
All kinds.
Yeah, everyone from Deepak Chopra to Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, both of whom I believe have spent time in Fairfield in years past. And another Fairfield connection is Marcy Shimoff, the author of Happy for No Reason, excuse me, and Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul. And she's another former Fairfielder. So we've got a lot of Fairfield connection here.
Yeah, a lot of wonderful people have been kind enough to say very kind words. You know, one person who also was great was Jon Kabat-Zinn. I don't know if you know that name. He's the founder of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction.
Mm.
And he said... Actually, I was with him recently in an event. He said this book was probably one of the most profound books he's ever read, and it is a series of Zen koans, if you were into Zen Buddhism. And actually, a number of people, in fact, one quote or one endorsement you didn't mention, which is actually quite interesting because it might be unexpected, is Glenn Beck. I don't know.
I did see that one.
As you know, he's a right-wing pundit. And, in fact, he's quite religious. And, in fact, there are a number of very positive quotes from very religious people about this book, even though in no way is this meant to be a religious book per se. But it shows that the story is one that is extraordinarily powerful, though, in the context of inspiration and spirituality and how to lead a life. And I think that's what's in that, and that's what's so moving for so many of these people. But I'd like to read with you for a little bit, and this is from a chapter called Growing Pains, and I'll just start there if that's okay.
That's fine.
Perfect.
I left earlier than usual for the magic shop because it was expected to be one of the hottest August days on record in Lancaster, triple digits. The sky was full of wispy clouds that looked more sooty than white. It wasn't sunny and it wasn't cloudy, and everywhere you looked was either brown or gray. I could feel the heat coming up from the ground through the pedals on my bike, so hot I thought it would singe the hair on my legs. I had to alternate one hand at a time on the handlebars so both hands didn't feel like they were burning. I tried riding no-handed for a while down Avenue K and was just getting up a good rhythm when I heard yelling from the field next to the Episcopal Church. I recognized the bigger kid, the one who was throwing the punches. He was two grades above me, and both my brother and I had been pushed around, hit a few times, and even spat on by him and his trusty sidekick. They were a gang of two and pretty much ruled Lancaster in the afternoon between the hours of 3 and 5 during the school year. obviously they were operating on extended summer hours because it was not even 10 a.m., and I could see one of them punching and kicking a kid while the other yelled and laughed. I couldn't see who it was because the kid on the ground was curled up and had his head down. His arms were wrapped around the top of his head trying to protect it. For a second, I thought it might be my brother, but then I remembered he had actually been at home when I left. I'm not sure what it was that made me get off my bike and start yelling at the boys. I was used to defending my brother, a habit that I would carry with me into adulthood, but I didn't go looking for fights, and certainly not with these guys. They didn't hear me at first, and as I walked toward them, it was like I could feel every punch and every kick they delivered to the boy on the ground. And my heart started to hammer in my chest. I took a deep breath and yelled again for them to cut it out. Stop it. The big guy was hunched over the kid, and when he heard me, he stood up tall. He gave me a snarly grin and then kicked the kid on the ground one more time in the stomach. It made me flinch and feel like I had just been kicked myself. Who's going to make me? Their attention diverted to me, and I saw the kid on the ground roll onto his back and start to get up. It was a kid I knew of from school. I couldn't remember his name. I knew his family had just transferred here last year. His dad was out at the airbase. The kid's face was bloody, and his glasses were in the dirt next to him. He had to be half the size of all three of us. I was as tall as these older kids, but they outweighed me by at least 30 pounds. I watched as he got to his feet and started staggering towards the church. I couldn't blame him for getting the hell out of there. You're going to take his place? The two boys took a few steps towards me, and I felt my mouth go dry and my ears start to buzz. I tried taking some deep breaths the way Ruth had taught me, but I couldn't seem to get the air to fill up my lungs. This was not going to be good. So you think you're a hero, some kind of freaking hero? I didn't say anything. I tried relaxing my legs and my hands like I had learned in the magic shop. I bounced up and down the balls of my feet and cleared out my thoughts. If I had to fight, I would. This time, I wasn't going to run. I'm going to kick your ass, and when we're going, and then we're going to take your bike. I still didn't say anything. I sensed the sidekick moving behind me a little, but I just stared straight at the guy who liked to punch and kick. He was the one who called the shots for the pair. He moved his face so close to my face that I could see some sort of white gunk in the corner of his mouth. It was getting hotter out by the second, and his face was sweaty and dirt-stained. "Unless you want to kiss my feet," he said. I thought of Ruth and Neil in the magic shop. They would be waiting for me to ride up right now. Would Ruth think I had skipped a day with her when I didn't show up? Would anyone find out me out here bleeding? Did the other kid go to get help? Did this guy wake up and have his cereal and milk and just run out of the house ready to beat people up, all without ever wiping his mouth? All of these thoughts started racing through my mind, but I just stared at the dried white gunk and pretended it was light. It was the light on the candle that Ruth had taught me. Kiss my feet. I looked up and into his eyes and spoke for the first time since I had told him to stop beating the other kid. No. He reached out and grabbed the front of my T-shirt. Kiss my feet, he threatened. His mouth began to make a smile like someone who knows he has power over another. His face got right up to mine, and I could smell and feel his breath. I closed my eyes for just a second, and in that second, something was different. I opened my eyes and looked directly into his. I stared deep into his eyes, the way we do when we're trying to really understand something or someone. You can do anything you want to me, but I'm not kissing your feet. He laughed and looked to the side at his friend. I saw him raise his eyebrows, and then he looked back at me. I stared at him again without blinking. He lifted his fist and cocked it behind his ear. I didn't flinch. My phone went off somehow, thinking I was talking to him.
Was that Siri or somebody else?
Yeah, no, it's Siri. Stop, Siri. sorry about that. I apologize.
That's okay.
I opened my eyes and looked directly into his. I stared deep into his eyes, the way you do when you're trying to really understand something or someone. You can do anything you want to me, but I'm not kissing your feet. He laughed and looked to the side at his friend. I saw him raise his eyebrows, and then he looked back at me. I stared at him without blinking. He lifted his fist and cocked it behind his ear. I didn't flinch. I just kept my eyes locked on his. And in that moment, I didn't care that he was bigger than me or that there was some other kid's blood on his fist. I wasn't going to back down. I wasn't going to give him the power to make me afraid. I wasn't going to kiss his feet or anyone's feet, ever. And for a second, our eyes locked together, and I saw him, and he knew I saw him. I saw his own pain and fear, a pain and fear that he had tried to hide with his bullying. His gaze broke from mine, and he looked at his sidekick and back at me. What a waste. He let go of my shirt and pushed me a little so that I stumbled back a step, but I didn't fall down. Then he looked at me again for the briefest of moments and turned away. It's too hot. Let's get out of here. I felt the other kid give a little push against my back, but it was more for show than anything else. I could tell he wasn't sure what just had happened. They both started walking away, and I could see the other boy talking to the bully. I knew he was asking why he didn't beat me up. The bully pushed him and said, "Shut up." Neither of them looked back.
That was Dr. James Doty reading from Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. You know, Dr. Doty, I often wonder when I read memoir if it was difficult to go back and visit some of those hard times, and because you have to really almost relive them to write as clearly and as powerfully as you have.
No, you're absolutely correct, and it was painful, and sometimes actually it's still painful to even read it still, because you know what makes the story so powerful is because they're real, but also because they have so much emotion tied to them, and they meant something, but. That being said, in other ways, it's extraordinarily cathartic, and it again it allows you to sit with something and just be with it, and that's okay. The reality is that all of our experiences ultimately create who we are, whether the experiences are good or bad, and any experience is one that potentially allows us to learn or to grow as a human being and to gain greater insight and self-awareness. So this book has been an incredible blessing to do, but you're absolutely correct. In many ways, it was painful to relive, and I certainly shed some tears going through that. But what's interesting is I think anyone who's read it has told me that they shed tears also.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say in your book that we grow through pain. We grow through difficult situations. That's why you have to embrace each and every difficult thing in your life. You say you feel sorry.
That's exactly right. In fact, really, if everything was perfect and easy, we would sort of be coddled and spoiled and actually probably very selfish.
And there are people like that.
Reality is that difficulties give us an incredible opportunity to grow, and when we get through difficulties, it actually strengthens us and makes us more resilient, and hopefully it also allows us to recognize that others have difficulties and accept the reality that our lives are not lives of us being alone, but what helps us move forward in our lives are the connection with other people and recognizing that our success does not manifest just with our actions, but with interacting with others who hopefully, if our actions are such that they help us along the way and root for us and are there for us.
Okay, you have, well, I took a lot of notes here, but would you explain exactly what the vagus nerve is and why it's so important?
Sure. What a lot of people don't appreciate is that there is this extraordinary brain-heart connection, and that brain-heart connection is manifested through something called the vagus nerve. And this is not just a one-way traffic where you some signal comes from your brain to your heart. Your heart also gives information to your brain. And there, as part of the vagus nerve manifested within this, is something called the autonomic nervous system. And this is the system that is one part, the sympathetic nervous system, which is associated with what many of us call the fight or flight mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is the parasympathetic nervous system, which is often associated with relaxation or connection. And for so many people in the world, the nature of their functioning in the world, remember, we were never meant to live in a modern, technologically advanced world. Our DNA has not changed in the last 200,000 years. And we're used to actually spending most of our time relaxed, connecting, caring for our offspring and those who are part of our group, and then responding to threat, but it's an immediate threat. In modern society, there's sort of a chronic distractions or sensory overload, which kicks in the sympathetic nervous system and results in the release of hormones that are very deleterious to our health. And as a result, people have increased blood pressure, decreased cardiac function, depressed immune systems, and the release of stressor hormones such as cortisol. And in the long term, these are very, very negative in terms of health. But the amazing thing is the parasympathetic nervous system, which is associated when it is kicked in, if you will, or when you increase your vagal tone, results in the release of hormones that actually are associated with pleasure, with relaxation, with connection, and result in your muscles being relaxed, your sphincters, believe it or not, loosening, you being present, if you will, and also allowing for what we call your executive control function manifest in your left frontal area to work its best. And that's associated with creativity and productivity and focus. And also allows you to, if you will, have the best information for decision-making versus in the other context of the sympathetic nervous system being engaged, which is one of simply reacting to survive. And those are completely different circumstances. So there is this connection. And in emotional states, believe it or not, your heart can be profoundly affected. And in fact, there's something called broken heart syndrome.
I know. That was
described in Japan.
That was interesting.
People, because they were so emotional, it had such a profound effect on their heart that their heart just stopped.
Wow.
Broken heart for sure.
Yes.
Mom, did you have some other things you wanted to ask?
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. One thing I was curious about was the Center for, what's it called exactly? The Center for
Compassion and Altruism Research and Education.
So how do you research compassion and altruism?
Yeah, so there are a variety of tools. One is something called functional magnetic resonance imaging, where we look at the metabolic state of different parts of your brain. As an example, we know that when you are empathic or take on the emotional state of another, this is associated with a certain part of your brain called the insula, that when you feel threatened, the metabolism in this part of your brain called the amygdala increases. And that actually when you're kind or are giving to another, these areas of your brain that are associated with reward, such as the nucleus accumbens, also increase in their metabolism. So that's one way. The other is by measuring different parameters in your blood. As an example, I mentioned stress hormones. So if we can actually train people to increase their vagal nerve tone and get into this parasympathetic nervous system state, if you will, which is the state of connection and relaxation, we see that their cortisol levels go down, their immune system is boosted, and so there are certain measures of that. We can now measure actually genetic expression, and even as an example of inflammation, and even as with as short of a period of a intervention or a meditation focused on caring or kindness, we can see that gene expression is affected in terms of, as an example, the creation of proteins associated with inflammation. And then there's self-report studies, which is another way. So there's a whole broad, wide variety of techniques where we can examine, if you will.
So the results of this research have a practical application.
Absolutely. We've developed different interventions or techniques, compassion cultivation training, compassion skills training, resilience training, whereby individuals who, if you will, are stressed out, who are not particularly compassionate, if you will, can be trained to maximize their genetic potential for being compassionate. And the importance of this is that it makes you feel better, it gives your life meaning, and it is associated with significant improvements in physical and mental health, and ultimately in longevity.
Well, and Dr. Doty, we are unfortunately out of time. We could go another hour.
Yeah, we could. Absolutely.
So thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate your kindness. And again, I thank your listeners for hopefully buying this book, and
yes,
I hope it does, in fact, help them lead their lives and give some inspiration, which is what all of us look for in our lives.
Absolutely. And I hope you do make it to Fairfield one of these days.
Oh, yes. And please, if you do,
you know,
stop and see us. Yeah.
Mom, do you have some final words for us
today? I do. That this is perfect for this gentleman. Success is about making a difference, not just about making money.
If you missed part of the show, we're rebroadcasting Monday morning at 8 a.m. if you're listening to us on Friday. And you can also get the podcast on writersvoices.com. It'll be up in about a week.
Now, tell all your friends to listen on Monday if they didn't hear it today.
And stay tuned now on Fridays for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. See you next week on Writers Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP 100.1 FM.